This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of August 15th, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 199. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And the big deal feature. No more charges in the BC legislature corruption scandal? Ex-clerk Craig James will stand trial next January for breach of trust and fraud, but ex-sergeant-at-arms Gary Lenz will not. Hear reaction from former Speaker Daryl Plekis. And China upheld a death sentence for one Canadian and sent another to jail for 11 years, just before the extradition hearing for Meng Wanzhou finally began in Vancouver. Laura Harth of the human rights group Safeguard Defenders offers her analysis. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or the Olympics are over in the land of the rising case counts? Onward to the Paralympics in a few weeks, unless the pandemic shuts those down. Then, the next big circus is the United Nations Climate Party in the first half of November in Glasgow. The day after the Olympics closed in Tokyo, the UN Climate Committee published its latest Doomsday Report, some 85 days before the biggest gathering of people and planes in the Scottish city since the 2014 Commonwealth Games. The host UK government has signed up corporate sponsors like consumer goods conglomerates Unilever and Reckitt, supermarket chain Sainsbury's, and Big Pharma's GSK. Even Microsoft, Hitachi, and Rupert Murdoch's Telecom Sky are coming to the party. Like the Tokyo Olympics, the Glasgow Climate Party was postponed for a year, but if the participants are so worried about saving the planet, why didn't they meet on Zoom last fall? Meanwhile, in the home and native land, Democracy Watch says Justin Trudeau's snap election is illegal, dishonest, and unfair, and dangerous for many voters. Co-founder Duff Conacher points to the British Supreme Court's 2019 ruling against Boris Johnson's early election law. The High Court said it prevented Parliament from making laws and supervising the executive branch of government. Canada's 2015 and 2019 elections were on fixed dates. In 2011, Stephen Harper lost a confidence vote. Trudeau wants to go straight to an election without a confidence vote. Parliament is not a place of harmony, but it has functioned under the Liberal minority, and the next fixed election date is October 2023. So the only reason for an election is a Trudeau power grab. Governor General Mary Simon got the best job of her life from Trudeau, but will she have the guts to use her power and tell him that the fourth wave of a pandemic is not the time for an election? If she doesn't, then it will be a sad day in Canada for both democracy and public health.
What do you think? Email bob@thebreaker.news.
This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. The special prosecutors for the RCMP investigation of the BC legislature corruption scandal announced last week there will be no additional charges against senior staff at the seat of government. That means ex-sergeant-at-arms Gary Lenz will not be charged. Lenz and ex-clerk Craig James were both escorted out of the legislature on November 20, 2018 after they were suspended indefinitely. Speaker Daryl Plekis had called the RCMP to investigate the two most senior officers of the legislature. Special prosecutors David Butcher and Brock Martland did not give reasons for their decision. James goes on trial next January for breach of trust and fraud over $5,000. He has pleaded not guilty. Both James and Lenz demanded their jobs back in 2018, but they both retired in 2019 in disgrace through separate investigations into their misconducts. Special guest on this, the 199th edition of the Breaker.News podcast, is Daryl Plekis, who was the Speaker of the Legislature from 2017 to 2020. He is also the retired independent MLA for Abbotsford South. I asked Plekis for his reaction, especially after Lenz claimed that he is exonerated.
Gary Lenz was found guilty under the Police Act of an egregious breach of trust and negligent of duty. And importantly, that neglect of duty and the whole matter of breach of trust is related to his failure as the de facto police chief for the legislature to investigate the clerk. That was, of course, my primary concern. That was the primary concern of my chief of staff, Alan Mullen. Like, you know, here we have somebody who we would expect would take these matters very seriously and consider that they deserve investigation. We had a very serious allegation against an elected official by a staffer. He refused to investigate that. So at the end of the day, you say, well, you know, this is completely inappropriate behavior. It is a full-blown willful blindness and neglect on behalf of somebody who's charged with making sure that, you know, matters that are raised by staffers get investigated. And, you know, it's also important to remember, you know, from the beginning, you know, the kinds of things I was bringing forward, it went well beyond what I was observing myself. It was driven in the first instance by people coming to me, employees coming to me and saying, hey, this is inappropriate behavior. This, in my view, is criminal. This is legal. I want this investigated. I received requests in writing to say, I want this, and I want this reinvestigated after it was blown off by Gary Lenz, for example. And I pleaded, as did my chief of staff, with Gary Lenz to have these matters investigated. And he just had his reasons for not doing it. He did not want outside police involvement. So he did not want an audit. You know, it was made it extremely difficult. So, you know, I'm thinking, number one, I have a responsibility as an elected official to take these matters seriously. Whether or not they're determined to be criminal is not for me to decide. That's why we have police. Police do an investigation, and then the prosecution service decides whether or not to accept the work that the police have done on the investigation. Now, why the prosecution service decided not to move forward, I'm sure they had good reason. You know, they know what they're doing. I don't think, it certainly doesn't say to me that it provides conclusive proof that Gary Lenz was innocent of wrongdoing. You will recall that McLaughlin found him innocent of wrongdoing. And then, of course, another investigator found that, no, that's just not true. She did not get that right. The only reason she found that way was because he had lied to her. You know, I mean, we'll just have to wait now to see what happens with Craig James. And we want to remember that the kinds of things that Gary Lenz was failing to do were directly related to some of the things he was charged with. So that should tell us something, that he's refusing to do it, and that ultimately it ends up in the hands of the prosecutor and he's going to trial. The other thing to remember, which is important, is Craig James was charged with a number of things which related to issues that happened long before I got there. I mean, that this notion that somehow that it's all related to, you know, I saw this, and, you know, I mean, there was all kinds of inappropriate spending. But, you know, we had policies at the legislature which you could drive a truck through. There was no real safeguards against inappropriate spending. So you know right off the top that it's going to be difficult to get some kind of criminal consideration of that, because, you know, they just come back to, well, you know, so what if he did this or did that, spent this, spent that? It's against the policy, or there was no policy. There was no policy saying that city couldn't do this or that. So that complicates matters. And likewise with Gary Lenz. But at the end of the day, it's disappointing to me to see that Gary Lenz continues to say aloud that he's been wronged. He's been completely innocent. He's been completely truthful. He had the audacity to say he's always been truthful. Well, he was found very specifically guilty of lying to the retired Chief Justice McLaughlin. How he can say these things in the face of all of that, to me, is remarkable. At one point, I guess he was asked the question of whether or not he was going to sue me. I am not worried about that in the slightest. In fact, in part, I welcome that possibility, because at that point, then it would allow us through a civil procedure to expose, all that happened. It's a very different bar that's set at the civil level. I'm confident he's not going to go down that path, because of course that's going to turn out to look very badly on him. But we'll just have to see where it goes.
The whistleblowers, the ones who brought this to your attention originally, the people who worked in this environment, still don't have the justice that they seek.
It's the worst part of the whole story is, and particularly recently with one person who came forward with an allegation of fraud being committed by an elected official. And that person was instantly fired. It just goes to show, what happened to him happened to many people before him. You raise a concern, you say you shouldn't be doing this, it's dishonest. You're taking from the public purse. And then the first order of business of certain individuals is to say that person has got to go and there will be no investigation into this matter at all. So I feel badly about that, because in the one case that was a very important one for the current complaint that was put forward and there was no charges, that person took a severe beating as a consequence of his trying to do the right thing. That's why I say if it was a civil matter, like these matters would still be exposed, because the facts are the facts. What went to police in that particular case, or one case, was a report, but which included an 8-inch binder of very specific evidence. That's still there. It's just unfortunate that people don't have the opportunity, the average person won't have the opportunity to see for themselves, what all went wrong. I know you have some sense of that. And hopefully, you'll have an opportunity to write about that in some length so people can, see the truth. Again, I'm sort of past the idea these days of thinking that anything will be done about the truth. Because I look, around the globe and, what happens when people raise concerns about people in political life. Nothing happens. There's just all the first order of business is, how do we get around this? How do we stop the investigation? We're not going to do anything. That's troubling. What we need is the kind of thing as well in BC that they had in New York, where the allegations were made about the governor of New York, and people took it seriously. Like, oh boy, do I wish that they would do the same thing here in British Columbia. But there's all kinds of people at work, as fast as I'm saying that, trying to put a stop to any kind of inquiry. And I know you're aware of some of this, but some of these allegations of the same kind levied against the governor of New York were happening in BC in a very, very serious manner. And people moved heaven and earth, despite my calling it to their attention, moved heaven and earth to bury it. It hasn't seen the light of day. All I can do is hope that at one point, or the collectively, the whistleblowers will get together and, in mass and raise hell. But until you get that momentum going, I'm just not confident about people correcting a wrong. Like, I would be the first to say that we all make mistakes. It's how we respond to those mistakes which distinguishes one person or one organization from another. And in our case in British Columbia, I believe that we've done that very badly. I'm also disappointed to see that despite the fact that, over my time there, after raising these concerns, there was a whole series of policy changes to tighten things up so there's more oversight, more accountability, which was long overdue, despite the fact that the clerk was saying that, everything was wonderful. It wasn't. It was pretty obvious that that was the case by virtue of our need for these new policies. But the one policy that I was asking for from the beginning, which I considered the most important, was a policy respecting whistleblowers. And to this day, as I'm talking to you now, that has not happened. It's happened with respect to governments. It's happened with respect to the BC government. But somehow, the legislature has found it, unnecessary to move forward with that policy. And one would think with all that's happened, if they had one scintilla of respect for all those people who tried to do the right thing, they would at least introduce a policy so that it doesn't happen again.
Daryl Plekis's main regrets are that there was no major whistleblower protection or freedom of information reform instituted at the legislature under his watch. The legislature has made baby steps toward whistleblower protection and transparency, but they are baby steps. The NDP government House leader Mike Farnworth promised in early 2019 that the legislature would finally be added to the Freedom of Information Law, but there is no hint when or if that will ever happen.
I've come to learn it's like the lessons that can be learned from the show House of Cards. I mean, the announcement, oh yes, we're going to do something about this. We're going to just with this freedom of information, for example. And then everybody backs off and says, well, thank goodness they've said they're going to do something about that. And then they just ride it out and nothing happens. It's a strategy. Like, all we want to do is just make it go away, make the complaint go away, but we have no intention of ever changing anything. It's so discouraging that people in public office would do this. Like in this day and age, like why wouldn't we be moving heaven and earth to facilitate as much transparency as possible? Well, as you know, like I've identified a whole list of things, more than 24 things, which I say happen at the legislature, which facilitate corruption. And certainly that whole matter of not having access to information is one of the main things. Like people just can't get their hands on it. I mean, it was incredibly difficult. I know as police were doing their investigation for them to get access to information. When you have that kind of situation where people are saying, I know you've got a suspicion, I know you've got a concern, but sorry, I'm not going to give you the information which is going to be helpful to you verifying, what went on or helping you resolve your concern. It's just mind-boggling to me because, again, in other parts of the world, this would not be tolerated for a minute. The only place around the world where this kind of behavior is tolerated is in the political atmosphere, and it's tragic. I mean that we have to do it. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be more calls for this once all things roll out with response to how the pandemic was held. But even there, of course, you know, with all the vaccine purchases, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, we're in the dark about it. And that's not to say anything at all has gone untoward with any government in the world. But at the same time, it isn't enough that we can say, oh, that's the way it is because you told me so. We need to have independent analysts like yourself looking at it and saying, well, I've had a look at this and I have reason to believe it's all true. We don't even have that opportunity.
How are you spending this summer, this very hot summer, and what's next for you and your career?
Well, you know, one of the things is, you know, I was a professor all my life, so I'm still a professor. I'm Professor Emeritus, so I will go back to teaching a course or two. Do that. Just thinking about a lot of things. You know, spent a lot of time since then just thinking. Doing a few renos around the house. You know, so I've could say I've completely enjoyed my time away from the legislature. You know, it's one of those things where when you're out of it, you get to see how it eats at you. Like, I think jokingly, I think I might have told you before, I gained 28 pounds after I got elected. Well, I've lost most of that back now. And it's just different to be a lot more fun to be surrounded by people and talking to people who are, you know, there's other things in life than, you know, what's going on there. That's not to say it's not important. Of course it is, but it's just a different world.
That was Daryl Plekis, the former Speaker of the BC Legislature from 2017 to 2020, and the former independent MLA for Abbotsford South. It was a busy week in the ongoing Cold War with China. A court in China upheld a death penalty for Abbotsford, BC's Robert Schellenberg, who was convicted of drug smuggling. Then another Canadian, hostage Michael Spavor, was sentenced to 11 years in jail. Spavor was tried in secret in March for alleged spying. Canadian Ambassador to China, Dominic Barton.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this decision rendered after a legal process that lacked both fairness and transparency. Our thoughts are with Michael and his family during this difficult time.
The next morning in Vancouver, Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou's extradition hearing finally began in BC Supreme Court. The U.S. wants to try Meng on fraud charges. The hearing is scheduled to August 20th. The decision will come at a later date and is subject to appeals. Joining me from Rome is Laura Harth with Safeguard Defenders, a human rights organization which advocates for the rights of teachers, lawyers, and journalists across Asia.
Laura, what is your reaction to the sentences this week handed down by the Chinese courts?
Well, on the one hand, obviously, we see an acceleration, an escalation from China's part. You've talked about the hostage diplomacy. I think we can call it hostage taking. That might be a correcter term because there's nothing diplomatic on this. Obviously, China is trying to use all its cards before the Meng Wanzhou decision is expected. So on the one hand, obviously, it's very harsh, especially the Robert Schellenberg case, that sentence. There's nothing harsher. The sentence for Michael Spavor is especially harsh also, given the accusations, given the circumstances. But there's this small opening of deportation, which was expressly mentioned. Now, usually, China does not actually deport its prisoners before the full sentence is served. But again, the reason they might have put it in so clearly may point to the fact that they are trying to use it as some kind of leverage to pressure, obviously, Canada. They still have another card up their sleeve, which is obviously the sentencing which is expected of Michael Kovrig. We don't know whether that may happen still before a decision is reached in the extradition request for Meng Wanzhou, or if they will keep that for after. So we'll still have to see what happens. What is very clear from all of this that China clearly does not understand, let's say, the legal system, the division between powers that exists in countries, democratic countries under the rule of law. And so they are trying to use, leverage really these people to obtain the return of Meng Wanzhou at all costs. So very scary developments, unfortunately, something that everybody needs to be very wary of. And I think increasingly Western citizens traveling or in China should be very wary of, because it just shows how they can use and leverage any citizen basically against their governments, or at least try to.
Yeah, we saw with this show of support at the Canadian embassy in Beijing, that photo of diplomats from more than a couple of dozen countries. There's a coalition against this tactic by China. There's also talks amongst various governments what to do with China, whether it's with the concentration camps against the Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang, whether it's the crackdown on basic freedoms in Hong Kong. The Olympics in Tokyo ended, the Summer Olympics in Tokyo ended. We're now facing the Winter Olympics coming up in February, coming quickly in February in Beijing. What do you think governments will do to approach that if the situation remains the same, especially with, again, the hostage takings, as you call them, as well as these other human rights abuses?
Well, human rights organizations have increasingly been calling the Winter Olympics in 2022 in Beijing the genocide Olympics. And so there are clear calls also from parliaments, at least for diplomatic boycotts of these games. Obviously, many human rights organizations are increasingly calling for a full-out boycott of these games, especially as they feel, we all feel, that definitely diplomats, politicians, but also athletes should not be used for the propaganda machinery of the Chinese Communist Party, which is obviously, we've seen that in Beijing in 2008. And I think we can expect that even more under the new regime of Xi Jinping, that this will be kind of used as a victory lap for the Chinese Communist Party to push its propaganda out into the world. And I think many people have been asking, rightly, with everything that's going on, you know, the Tokyo Games were postponed by 1 year, obviously for the pandemic. That's very unfortunate. We all understand how harsh that is for the athletes that have been working for their whole lives, maybe, to arrive at these games. But do we want to be complicit as nations, as citizens, as athletes, as politicians, in supporting, in kind of way, in giving a platform to the propaganda for a regime that is perpetrating these crimes, not just against its citizens, which is bad enough in itself, obviously, but also increasingly against citizens from other countries, and which is openly attacking the international rules-based order.
That was Laura Harth with Safeguard Defenders joining me from Rome.
Justin P.J. Trudeau. No! Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways. Okay. First of all, it is not the habit of the government to announce announcements that we're going to be announcing later. We make announcements when we're ready to make the commitment and actually take action.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In Kyoto news, disease experts call to halve foot traffic in Tokyo to curb COVID-19. The number of new COVID-19 cases nationwide totaled over 18,000 on August 12th, topping the previous record of almost 16,000. The capital's seven-day rolling average of new infections was almost 4,000 per day, up 9% from a week earlier. Experts called on officials to reduce crowds in situations where infection risk is high, including underground food sections at department stores and shopping malls. In the Japan Times, Tokyo's hospitals under strain as latest COVID-19 wave hits older people harder. The fifth wave of the pandemic, fueled by the deadlier, more contagious Delta variant, is triggering new infections at a rate that has been surpassing previous records in the greater Tokyo area consistently since late July, when the Olympics started. As of August 12th, almost 3,700, or 61% of the capital's nearly 6,000 beds for virus patients were occupied, according to the Tokyo Metropolitan Government. The Paralympics, which start later this month, may go ahead without spectators like the Olympics. In the Taiwan news, Chinese netizens try to pad their Olympic stats with Taiwan's medals. By the closing ceremonies, the Chinese state broadcaster no longer had a leg to stand on because the U.S. had not only reached the top of the gold medal tally with 39 golds to China's 38, but also beat its communist counterpart by every other measure, including 41 silvers to 32, 33 bronzes to 18, and 113 total medals to 88. In response, some Chinese netizens created their own fantasy medal table that lumped in Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Macau to give the enlarged China 42 golds, 37 silvers, and 27 bronzes for a total count of 110, and posted it to the Weibo social media platform. In the post, they wrote, "Congratulations to the Chinese delegation for ranking first in gold medals and the total number of points." That's around the rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, 19-year-old becomes one of Oregon's youngest COVID-19 fatalities. The Union County woman is one of only four Oregonians younger than 20 to die with COVID-19 since the pandemic began, and she appears to be the third person in her extended family to die from the virus in a matter of weeks. According to the health authority, the teen tested positive for coronavirus on July 27th and died Tuesday at Providence Portland Medical Center. She had underlying conditions, according to the state. In the Seattle Times, Canada reopened its borders to Americans this week, but the crowds haven't arrived just yet. Law enforcement officials on both sides of the U.S.-Canada border say wait times to cross between the two countries have been minimal in Washington state, and the August 9th border opening hasn't prompted a stampede at Vancouver International Airport either. On August 8th, the airport logged almost 2,000 passengers arriving from the U.S. On August 9th, that number bumped up to more than 2,100, then fell on August 10th to 1,400. According to Destination Vancouver, the pandemic lockdowns cost the metropolitan area $9.8 billion in visitor spending, $2.6 billion in taxes to local governments, and 72,000 full-time equivalent jobs. In Czech news, RCMP arrest man on tarmac after breaching airport perimeter at YYJ. Officers responded to a 911 report August 7th of a man who had driven his vehicle through the perimeter fencing and into a restricted area of the Victoria International Airport. Officers with Sydney RCMP said the man was transported to hospital following his arrest over concerns that the man's actions may be the result of a medical issue. And this headline in the Breaker.News, Vancouver Mayor a no-show during June's Heat Dome weekend. Read the stories behind the headlines at the Breaker.News.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Robert Wood and Barb Faulkner of Lynn Valley. They raised funds and donated hundreds of fans to senior citizens living in North Vancouver care homes. The fans will keep them cool and help them survive the latest heat wave. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
Vaccine. I'm begging of you, please don't hesitate. Vaccine. Because once you're dead, then that's a bit too late. I know I'm trying to be funny now, but I'm dead serious about the vaccine. I think we all want to get back to normal, whatever that is, and that would be a great shot in the arm.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of August 15th, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on August 15th in 1939, The Wizard of Oz premiered? In 1965, the Beatles played Shea Stadium, and in 1969, Woodstock began in upstate New York. Now you know. Send me your feedback and send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.